Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. John Endres, Dr. John Endres. John, how are you doing?
Mr. Hello. Very well. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Very good to have you with us. And also very good to have with us is Sara Ghan. Sara, how are you?
I'm well. I am Ms.
Ms. Sara Ghan. Right, let us get into the news of today. And the weekend, you know, these things move so fast these days that you can't always tell exactly what is going on. But on Friday, we had this sort of shock crisis that looks like the ANC and DA's attempts to negotiate on the budget are about to collapse, and that the ANC is going to walk away and declare that it's going to make some sort of deal with the EFF and all of the potential economic consequences that would have. The Rand got a little bit shaky, and investors were all tuttering and worrying about this. Apparently, this came after the ANC said to the DA that you should just vote for the government for the budget without any concessions, which the DA said was basically, in their opinion, calling off the negotiations entirely. However, within, I guess, 24 hours after that, it looks like the ANC reopened negotiations with the DA and said, no, actually talks back on. They sent some sort of document to the DA, and on Sunday, the DA sent back some amendments to that document, but they said that they were pretty happy with it. So according to reporting from News 24 and Business Day, the two main parties, the DA and the ANC, are close to striking a deal on the future of the economy that will involve passing the budget. The ANC has apparently, according to News 24's reporting, agreed to, quote, many of the DA's proposals, including sweeping spending reviews, devolution of ports and rail authority, and the co-chairing of Operation Vulindlela in the presidency. And they will be announcing what the details are soon. Steenhuisen, the leader of the DA, said, quote, we've moved a lot closer to a deal in the last 24 hours, and that they were targeting a, quote, win-win solution, that his party would end up in a position of, quote, co-governance of the economy, not subjugation. That's quite strong phrasing. It looks like the EFF remains shut out of things for now, especially if this deal does go ahead. One of the concessions it looks like the DA may have made is that they will agree to a VAT hike for 1 year, which can be removed if there are significant cost savings from this comprehensive spending review. It looks like they say they're going to be getting more control over key economic issues. So, John, let me start with you. We obviously don't know all the details yet. They will become apparent to us in the coming hours, days. But what do you think are the main things that might constitute a sort of win for the DA here, and what would constitute a bad deal? The devil's in the details when it comes to these complex coalition stuff. And what to you would be a real sign that the DA's position in the GNU has changed from that of, as Steenhuisen said, subjugation to co-governance?
I think one preliminary remark to make here is that there were quite a lot of dismissive comments from European observers on our coalition forming process, where, for example, the Germans take 3 months to form a coalition, and they've got a 300-page document, an agreement that spells out all the details of, you know, what happens when and what you agree to, what you don't agree to, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, here's the South Africans, like with the little flimsy 2-page document that they wrote, they scribbled on a napkin somewhere within 2 weeks. It can never work. Like, how can you have a coalition based on something like that? But the German coalition fell apart, despite the 300-page document. And the South African one is still hanging on there. And I think it may turn out that having a kind of flexible working arrangement is actually better than having a rigid one. Because effectively, that's what needs to happen, is that you can't account for all contingencies. You don't know all the things that are going to happen. And what you need to have is the scope and the flexibility to negotiate, which I think we're seeing play out now before our eyes. It's really useful. Like, imagine if they'd written an agreement. So go ahead, Nick.
If I can make a comment on that, it's not like the German system is all it's cracked up to be. I mean, one of the problems I've learned recently about the Germans is that they vote abstention in EU debates when their own government ministers don't agree on things. So despite this huge document, they're constantly disagreeing, which means that Germany votes abstention on almost every piece of EU regulation. And that's exactly because, as you say, you know, they're just constantly in negotiations, and it doesn't actually work as well as they claim it to.
Yeah. And it's exactly. And I think our approach is a bit nerve wracking because you don't know what's going to happen, right? So you have the situation where yesterday I was writing a note on the budget and this battle. And of course, no idea how it's going to play out. Because as you said on Friday, the news was it's all falling apart. You know, the DA is out, the EFF is waiting in the wings. That's it for the GNU. And then on yesterday evening, we had news that they're talking to one another again. It's brinkmanship because they're getting close to the 2nd of April when they have to, like the Finance Committee in Parliament has to agree on the fiscal framework. That's like one of the many steps that has to happen to pass the budget. And they've got to get a deal before then, ideally, if they can. So they're talking to one another again now. So it's a fascinating process to witness. And I'm very happy to see that it's working out in the kind of flexible, work it out as you go along South African way, a way of muddling through. Because as long as the parties involved are playing that game, I think it can actually work out quite nicely. And the ANC at first didn't want to play ball. They didn't want to follow this process because I think they were still stuck in majority mindset and saying, you know, we call the shots, like we write the budget, we pass the budget, we don't need your help. They've now been faced with the reality that they do need the support of other parties to do this, which is very unpleasant. And they've now gotten into the negotiation phase of saying, okay, like, here's the DA proposal, here's what they want. Well, let's read it and say what we can accept, what we can't accept, what we want to change, what alternative proposals we are going to make, finally. And that's really useful. I thought the DA has played this really well. They've been hard line on this and saying, look, you know, we need some more substantive concessions if we're going to agree to the VAT increase than just being told to suck it up and vote for it. And they've made some good proposals. What I also thought they'd have done very well is to focus this on economic growth. So they're sort of not saying, you know, we need DA talking points, manifesto points to be in this budget or in the negotiations. They said, no, it's economic growth. We need jobs. We need the economy to grow. There's some things you can do that, to achieve that. Here's our proposals. If you've got other ideas, put them forward. But we've got to get the economy to grow. It's a very good message, a powerful message. And I think they did really well on that. In terms of what would constitute a success, I think if the DA is able to assert some of the demands that it had that will strengthen investor confidence, maybe address some of the more worrying provisions of the Expropriation Act, or at least get the ANC's commitment to look at that. That'll be helpful. The spending review will be helpful. Looking at public procurement processes will be helpful if the DA can make that stick. So they'll probably try to get the ANC to sign some sort of agreement that they commit to doing these things. But I wouldn't necessarily rely on the signature on the paper to make sure that those things happen. But nonetheless, it will improve the DA situation in the GNU. Nick?
Yeah, no, I guess that's the first point, Sara, coming to you, is that, you know, they did sign some documents already with the ANC, and by the DA's telling of it from their perspective, and I think from my perspective too, the ANC didn't honor those commitments that they signed. So, you know, getting them to sign another thing, it's like, well, you know, you commit to a spending review and then it comes time to the spending review and suddenly, oh, the committee is a different shape to what you thought it was going to be. And actually the focus is on something different, or, you know, the waters get muddied in such a way as to dilute what you were actually trying to do. So I think that's obviously, this is not the end of the situation. In fact, I saw Justice Malala, I think, wrote an opinion piece recently saying, you know, South Africa can't continue in this, you know, week to week crisis mode where everything is constantly being fixed at the last minute. And I actually honestly don't think we have another option on the table. So that's my first question, is just what you think of that. So you're nodding your head there. And the second one is, I wonder why the ANC decided to turn around and say, actually, we are going to make some sort of deal with the DA. You know, maybe this is all just brinksmanship out of the deal stuff. You know, you walk away to kind of prove your point. But maybe it's also the fact that they realize that if they bring the EFF into government, it's kind of all going to start falling apart in a big way. The rand is going to tank. the business confidence is going to evaporate like, you know, water in the hot desert sand. I don't know. What's your take on those two issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that sort of starting with the second first, I think there probably has been, you know, certain Western governments, IMF, World Bank, are all showing a certain level of impatience, as are the ratings agencies. So it's kind of, you know, there's the talk about the extent to which the ANC is mismanaging the economy is not as subtle as it once was. I think that's coming. You've got the fact that the one thing they have to know is that they're probably in hiding to nothing with either the EFF and or MK on board. So whatever legacy they have still actually lies in relationship with the DA rather than anybody else. The fact that on the other hand, that they essentially needed the face saver of, yes, you can have your 0.5% for a year and less than until. I mean, if the government were more mature, adding 0.5% now would be off the table, because it's frankly, if nothing else, it's just it's a pain in the arse. You're doing it really to save an image thing, which really shouldn't be necessary at this stage. But I think there's something to be said for us operating by crisis. The crisis puts pressure, and pressure gets things done. It's a bit like, you know, if I was stabbed in the heart by someone, I'd rather have an overworked South African doctor try and repair me quickly than go to Germany where nobody's ever seen this emergency spirit of the moment stuff. It's a bit like that, and I think we're actually well attuned in a way to governing by the seat of our pants. But I think what's probably the most important is that the DA's got to seem to be not the party that scuppers the GNU, but at the same time keeps a very wary eye on what the government is doing. And because it's now dealing with something that wasn't a piece of legislation signed into power before the election, but something absolutely fundamental in every respect to this government, I think they can afford to be a little dubious and be prepared to show it at the same time as being cooperative and helping to advance things if the space lets them. But they can't let it ride. They may seem to sort of pull back the reins quickly if needs be.
I want your final thoughts, John. I mean, you know, sort of where to from here. I suspect we're probably going to be having some version of this conversation in 3 weeks anyway, when inevitably the next disagreement arises. But what do you make of what's going on inside the ANC? Because it's kind of, I think it's been a bit of a struggle to define the groups inside the ANC, right? So there was this temptation, I think, during the early years of Ramaphosa to say that they were pragmatists and RET double down on the NDR faction. And that's not really true, because actually the so-called pragmatists were pretty much on board with the National Democratic Revolution fully. They maybe just disagreed about who should be running it and how fast it should be done. And we seem to be having a similar sort of fight in the ANC now, where there's, you know, ones who want to work with the EFF and MK and those who want to work with the DA. And I'm not sure if they really have huge ideological differences between them. In fact, I suspect a lot of this is more to do with personalities, which is that, you know, for example, if the ANC starts working with the EFF, then, Fikile Mbalula and Cyril Ramaphosa will almost certainly see their influence in the party diminish, whereas people like Lesufi and Mashatile will get ahead. But I don't know. What do you make of what's going on inside the ANC, the fact that they did decide to take this path and recommit to the GNU, it looks like, barring any last-minute news shenanigans, how do you define the factions inside the ANC?
Yeah, so I think that this entire experience highlights the fact that the ANC is facing existential decisions, because it is a party in decline in elections, financially, ideologically, in terms of reputation, credibility, and so on. And it now has to make the right choices, because making the wrong choices becomes very dangerous to the future of the party. And that is what the factions, I think, are slowly beginning to realize. And that process is taking quite a long time, which is why we're seeing a lot of this two steps forward, one step back, which will continue. So even though, you know, we might think that after this budget experience, the ANC has now fully realized that it is dependent on the cooperation of other parties, that the DA is there as a cooperative partner. It can make things work that way, and will now give the DA more influence. That's not what's going to happen. There's going to continue to be this contestation, and the ANC will continue trying to revert to its old ways. But I think bit by bit, these two parties are going to realize that their common benefit outweighs the fights that they keep having. In terms of the balance of power within the ANC, that probably shifts almost from day to day, depending on, you know, what's going on in the political environment. If the ANC and the DA strike a deal now, that should reflect a strengthening of the so-called, as you say, moderates, pragmatists, the ones willing to work with the DA. But it's every conclusion we reach here is going to be a provisional conclusion. I think it's perfectly plausible for the ANC to change its mind and start working with the EFF, which I think will not be a rational decision because it, you know, it spells bad things for the future of the ANC. But in a fit of pique, you know, you get upset at John Steenhuisen's tone of voice when he's demanding another thing. And you say, that's it, I've had enough, I'm walking away, I just cannot bear to work with these people. And you go to the EFF, that could happen. And, you know, that tightrope, I think, is one that we're still very much on, Nick.
Yeah, no, I agree completely with that. This is going to go back and forth endlessly. Sorry, you said something? Yeah.
Just to make a slightly off-color observation, they're probably nothing more than they know they have worked with the people who are in the EFF and they've worked with the people at MK, and they probably looked and said, oh dear God, you know,
this is a thing I've said over and over again. You know, these guys were MK and the EFF were in the ANC, and yeah, Now they're not anymore, and there's a reason for that. It may not be an ideological difference that they're like massively opposed in worldviews, but they for some reason really can't stand each other for the most part, and maybe they can make a deal to get around that, but it's not so easy. There's a lot of, I think, old grudges to be settled there on a very personal level. But yeah, no, it's just I agree completely, John, that this is probably going to be a back or forth, and you know, we're going to be having another crisis discussion about this in 3 weeks. Okay, let's go on to some comments by the chairman of ESCOM, in Tertunyati, who was talking in public at an investment seminar, and it was just kind of weird, some of the comments he made, because it was interesting to see how, in his thinking, race seemed to be kind of a central reason for a lot of his interactions with ESCOM. So he says that he was skeptical about chairing ESCOM during the load shedding crisis. But he eventually agreed to do so because he believed that this was important to counter what he calls the painful prejudice the perception of Black South Africans as being involved with failure. He said, quote, people like me, Black people, we are largely associated with failure. We mess things up. That's the narrative. We've been given things and those things end up destroyed. And for me, it was really another opportunity for us to turn around ESCOM and to demonstrate that there were many, many capable people out there who are to do these things. If they were given opportunities, they can do it. He went on to talk about the reduction in load shedding from when we had the really bad year in, 2023 of load shedding, when we had, you know, sort of stage six for 2 months of the year and most of the year being load shed. He says that the reduction in this has been due to ESCOM's 9-point generation recovery plan, which is primarily designed to address breakdowns and coal shortages. This plan increased maintenance, improved coal stocks. He talks a little bit about how basically they told Minister Pravin Gordhan, the Minister of Public Enterprises at the time, was very hands-on and meddling with everything in ESCOM, to butt out and to, quote, give us space for us to be able to do what we think we know how to do. He said that a key move was cutting out middlemen who had secured products from original equipment manufacturers that were driving up costs by 300%. He said, however, that ESCOM's main problem was this dysfunctional organizational culture, that leaders were not leading, people were promoted into levels of incompetence, there was a lack of difficult conversations. He went on to talk about how he thought that the narrative of sabotage in ESCOM was far less widespread than was actually true. But this is his sort of concluding remarks in this piece here. It says, in fact, this whole load shedding thing to me, it's like a proxy for black incompetence. That's what it represents. That's why people want to have it continue to be there, because it's representing that. He said, when load shedding started dwindling, you actually take something away from them. I don't know how many times people are saying, we're doing this, we're not doing that. They're not accepting the fact that things are actually improving. He then went on to quote Chinese dictator Deng Xiaoping, who said, it doesn't matter if a cat is black or white, as long as it catches the mice. He said, you need people who are going to be looking at these problems from different angles in order to come up with solutions that help you to address challenges that we are facing. We truly need each other. We are always trying to fight, and we are looking at difference. At the core, we all love this country. We all want the same things. We want security. We want a great education for our children. We want great healthcare for all of us. We need to be focusing on what makes our country great. He also made a comment in this that the only reason the DA had supported Andre de Rota, CEO of ESCOM, and then opposed other candidates was because essentially implied they were racists. But John, I don't know how to entirely unpack this, but it really comes across to me the sort of weird association of kind of race with, like, you know, that ESCOM needs to succeed to prove that blackness has got excellence in it or something like that, which to me is a completely insane way of framing this. If ESCOM succeeds, it's got nothing to do with the race of the people involved. It's to do with the competence of the people involved. And if ESCOM fails, it's also got nothing to do with the race of the people involved. It's got to do with the competence of the people who are involved. And I think this is how the ANC has poisoned so many debates in the country, is it has described itself as a black government. It's not a black government. It's an ANC government. And I think this takes us to, you know, you can see by what the chairperson says here that ultimately he believes that South Africans should work together, but he also at the same time believes that, you know, people of different races have fundamentally different perspectives on problems, which I do not think is true. I don't know. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, it's, I think, really interesting to see prominent people start to wrestle with these questions. And what it really boils down to into the background for me is a question of the rules that determine how we appoint people, how big SOEs buy from their, you know, suppliers, how we enforce accountability, how we reward competence. And I think the reflection of much of the failure of much of South Africa and of ESCOM as a microcosm is a reflection of bad rules being in place. It's BE-related rules, it's preferential procurement-related rules, it's impunity-related rules of not prosecuting corruption and crime, of being tolerant and forgiving of incompetence and underperformance. And it's these bad rules that are causing the problems. And because of the way these rules have been set up, I think much of that failure has been associated with blackness, which is a terrible thing. You know, it's a dreadful thing to be happening. And for people to be exposed to in South Africa, it's interesting to see Nyati now dealing with these questions. And I hope that the conclusion he eventually comes to will be the classically liberal one that has been espoused by the IRR for many, many years, which is, you know, treat people equally, no matter what their race is, and set up good rules so that people can succeed and society can succeed. And once you get that in place, you know, then everyone can move forward and stop obsessing about the skin color of the various people involved in the project. Nick?
That exactly is what sort of strikes me about the interventions he mentions as improving ESCOM, getting the overbearing micromanaging minister to butt out. That's something that non-racialists are totally on board with and would have thought, you know, we thought was a great idea. This is, you know, cutting out middlemen, which often there is a kind of a BE angle to that, right? Which is, why do you have these middlemen? Well, it's because you need suppliers, X number suppliers of a certain race in order to fulfill BE quotas, that kind of thing. And focusing on, you know, what people know and who's competent and who's leading. This is the essence of a merit-based system. And it's sort of weird because he's like throwing out all of these kind of racial terms and this racial view of looking at the world, but then circling around to arrive at the fact that simply, as you say, John, if the rules are better, you get a better system. I don't know, Sarah, what do you make of this?
I think he's sort of feeling a bit of the victim of, in fact, what as you've already discussed, the ANC has created. I mean, to the extent that he gets the feedback, the sense that, you know, this is poor black management or whatever it may be, it's directly in the hands of the ANC, and it goes back to card day deployment combined with BEE, leads to corruption. I mean, when you manage to literally have stolen your electricity supplier in the broad sense, that's quite some achievement. I mean, you've basically helped fast track the deindustrialization of the country. So at the bottom of this, in fact, is the ANC's racialism rather than anybody else's, because South Africans to a man will, if a job is done well, you can be from anywhere, look like anything, be of any color, it doesn't matter, it's done. I think the problem here is that I think he pointed to one thing about, you mentioned giving the space. And I suspect one of the problems for a considerable number of his predecessors who were in there to try and rectify the damage, the really serious damage, was they were not given the space. But, you know, obviously we as ordinary people won't have seen the machinations that involved politicians and the favored cronies, et cetera, et cetera. So one can just get a little sense of how little space senior management had. And he seems to have a solid private sector background. But maybe the crisis had been such that there was a recognition that if we get, you know, in having black leadership, we actually do have to give them the space to make the difference. And when you have the space, it's easier to make the difference. But there are also other issues. We don't tend to know enough about the extent to which the crime that was associated with Eskom has been dealt with. There's also the reality of the economy is just in such bad shape that there's less demand. So all of those factors come into play. I think it would have served Eskom really well to talk to the public, and under his watch, to talk to the public about what they've done about Eskom, and not how many gigabytes, gigawatts, and fiddly-faddlies they've managed to achieve, and, you know, energy availability, etc. That's important. But for the ordinary man in the street, the idea is to know is what are the problems they've managed to overcome? Where were the blockages?
Right.
And that's really, that's part of the communication. And I think he's probably gone in, you know, they've made changes, but, you know, all you need is the first bout of load shedding in a long time to say, well, what has actually gone wrong? And I've seen there was an article saying that Kusile was the most expensive power provider.
Yeah, ever created. Yeah, no, I saw that. I think that's a Chris Yaland was being interviewed there. But
so it's that perspective.
On that point, one of the reasons I am still a bit skeptical about Eskom's turnaround is because I'm not sure if the rules of the game, if those blockages have been fully removed. I think it's clear that there's been some progress on that. And, you know, the things he mentions here about leaders not leading and about cutting out middlemen, that all sounds good. About the minister not micromanaging, that sounds good too. I hope, you know, that I do not think that Dean McPherson is going to be the same as, you know, or whoever replaced Pravin Gordhan. I'm actually sure. Short moment. But anyway, is going to be as micromanagey. But John, any final thoughts on this one?
Just the observation that I think, you know, we are in this process of a transition between an old state and a new state. And there's a lot of uncertainty and volatility inherent in this transition. And also uncertainty about the outcome. But you might have noticed there's a new genre, I think, of YouTube videos also, which is very much the sort of black commentators lamenting South Africa's underperformance over the past 30 years. And I think this is reflective of the same commentary that we're hearing now from Inyati.
Yeah. Anyway. So for our last story, we're going to just talk about very briefly a short little event that happened in KZN. These sort of political events happen quite often. You get one political party, and all of them do this from time to time, says, look, we've just gotten a whole bunch of members defecting from other parties. This is, you know, a sign that the politics is moving in our direction. The DA does this sometimes. I mean, they did it recently when the ANC caucus leader in Cape Town defected to them. But we had the IFP saying that it was getting 150 new members from various political parties, half of which are coming from the EFF. They also said they were getting a couple of members from the DA, ATM, and ANC. And they said that this is the sort of power that is driving them into the next local government elections and a sign that the IFP was going to, you know, make a big impact in the next local government elections. Now, these are always just, you know, media stunts. Like, we don't really know who these people were, whether they really were members of other parties, how important they were in said parties, et cetera, et cetera. But Sara, I think there are two things that are probably true. And I think this might be a little data point in favor of them. One, that the IFP will probably have an okay or a pretty good 2026 local government elections. And also that the EFF, particularly in KZN, is in very big trouble. What do you make of this?
Well, I think I'll tell you what I like about what's happening is it's a bit of a sort of cynical take on it, but it's less to do with what the IFP has to offer in sort of ideological and policy terms than the fact that every month we're getting closer to the next election and it's really do or die stuff. People are going to lose the best livelihoods they have ever had and probably likely to ever have as a result. And I think they do, you know, particularly say, take the guys in the EFF, they're probably saying exactly that. You know, the EFF is in big trouble in the KZN. If we carry on hitching our star to this wagon, we're going to be, you know, standing in a Sasa queue next year. And I think they're just really looking at options and saying, where can we possibly save ourselves? And I don't think it's necessarily a terrible thing in the sense that it creates a much more realistic perspective of what's working and what's not. I guess they could have gone to the MK, but there's been a certain level of realism that says MK is not going to produce inclusive economic growth in anytime soon. So, right. You know,
and I suspect in terms of party structures, MK is pretty much a closed loop. You know, you don't get promoted in that party unless you already are in the club, I think.
And much could happen as a result.
Exactly. John, what do you make of this? I mean, do you agree with those two sort of suppositions at the beginning there? And, you know, I think a point that's often missed about South Africa is when you go to the sort of on the ground level of people who are sort of politically engaged or not that politically engaged but still vote, the differences between the supporters of different parties are often quite not nearly as stark as you think they'd be. There's a lot more agreement on things and there's, you know, for example, I've seen many times activists going from the ANC to the DA to the EFF in some parts of you know, South Africa. Here you've got people going from the EFF to the IFP. I'm sure there's every now and again you see people going from the MK to the DA. It's probably quite rare, but I'm sure it happens from time to time. I know that there were people who belonged to the Landless People's Movement in Soweto who joined the DA. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think we must be careful not to overinterpret it because, as you point out, there's a lot of this going on all the time. But one interesting question for me would be why these, was it 75 EFF people moved to the IFP? Half of 150? Yeah, roughly. Why they did not go to MK? So in other words, as an EFF member, supposedly you've got like an ideological outlook on life, like you care about Marxism and Fanonism. Do you think that you, like, is that going to be served more in the IFP or in MK? Or is it more about the question of your Zulu nationalism and your identification with that? In which case, yes, you might also have gone to MK because you would have said, like, you know, that's where Zuma is. That's where the, you know, the great Zulu leader, carrier of all the hopes of the nation is. That's where I should have gone. But no, they go to the IFP. And why would that be? Maybe it is because of a perception of relative strength and weakness, you know. So if you've got the feeling that the EFF is going down in the polls, it's weakening. The MK is beset by infighting and maybe also not looking like a great prospect. Then the choice you make is going to be IFP, unless you go ANC and...
Lost John for a second.
Can I make another suggestion to that? They went to the IFP for exactly those sort of Zulu national reasons, and they didn't go to MK because they've been under Floyd. It's again.
that's worth pointing out, I suppose. Yeah. Yes, is that if you didn't like Floyd, you're not going to leave the EFF for MK, I suppose.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just the final observation of not having chosen to go to the ANC instead, but perhaps also perceiving that party to be on the decline. And it's really interesting to see this movement towards IFP. You know, if 150 is a big number or 75 is a big number, which we don't quite know, but it seems like quite a big number, then that maybe we can read a little bit into that.
Yeah, no, I think KZN, I mean, look, the local government elections next year are going to be fascinating all over the place as we see, you know, whether all of these trends we saw at national level continue. Is the ANC going to continue its sort of general decline? Is the EFF going to collapse or rebound? Is how big a splash is MK going to make? These are all very big open questions. Will the DA manage to fend off the PA, or will the PA, you know, knock the DA out in a whole bunch of municipalities? There's so many things, but KZN in particular is going to be fascinating to watch. How well does MK do? Does the IFP, you know, secure its place as the kind of main kingmaker in KZN municipalities? And this is perhaps an early indication of how big a deal that fight is going to be. There's going to be a lot of movement, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's it for today. Thank you very much for watching the show today. We hope you enjoyed, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon.